Make that a little bit longer. I was out of school for 7 years after my undergraduate degree, working in the printing trades and doing union and community organizing. So mostly unsuccessfully, but. the printing went fine. okay, so I am going to talk about an idea about the quantum structure of space-time that is about as old as I am, which will fill in the gaps in the introduction. But then I am going to propose a completely crazy idea for applying this to a very modern problem, the cosmological constant problem. So let me start with Wheeler's old idea of space-time foam. The basic picture here is very simple. If you do some hand-waving arguments about the quantum fluctuations of space-time, it's easy to convince yourself, or perhaps misconvince yourself, that at the Planck scale, fluctuations in the metric become of order one. That means that a classical description in terms of a metric doesn't make sense. It means that the picture of space-time as a smooth geometry breaks down, and perhaps you get even fluctuations in topology. Now, of course, we don't know that this is true and won't until we actually have the right quantum theory of gravity, but it is a plausible intuitive picture. What's interesting about this, well, a bunch of things, but one of the interesting things is that Wheeler argued in the mid-1950s that understanding this was essential for what he called the compensation problem, which is what we now would call the renormalization problem, the problem of how to deal with the infinities coming out of quantum field theory. Now, these days, most quantum field theorists would tell you that we have a pretty good handle on that for non-gravitational systems, at least. But with a couple of glaring exceptions, one of which is the cosmological constant. Old here is in quotes because there are a set of problems revolving around the cosmological constant, but the old one is, why is it not huge? So the basic starting point is that gravity is universal. Gravity couples to everything with equal strength. If you had to pick out a fundamental principle of general relativity, that would be a pretty good choice. But that means in particular that gravity should couple to these quantum fluctuations, not just of space-time, but of ordinary matter fields. Now, we don't, and such fluctuations would show up as at lowest order as a cosmological constant. Now, to be fair, we don't really know how to calculate this. But if you use standard effective field theory arguments, you get numbers that, first of all, depend very sensitively on physics above the energies that we are able to measure now. But depending on your assumptions there, range from range over 60 some orders of magnitude, but from 100 inverse centimeters to something huge. But even this low number, just coming from the contributions of the standard model, is something like 58 orders of magnitude larger than what we observe, which some people have called the worst prediction in the history of theoretical physics. Although I spent some time trying to track down that quote, and everybody attributes it to somebody else. Perhaps more to the point, Hawking described this as the worst prediction of dimensional analysis in the history of physics, which is certainly fair. So this has led to desperate measures ranging from extremely fine-tuned cancellation to ad hoc changes in the Einstein-Hilbert action, typically non-local, that are designed just to decouple the cosmological constant. Yes?
Can I just ask whether you would view unimodular gravity?
Can
you comment on your view on it?
So there are various formulations of unimodular gravity. It is tricky to deal with higher loops, higher loop matter contributions. But these typically non-local modifications often start with unimodular gravity, but then hook in additional fields that cancel out higher loop contributions. In some sense, that's a matter of choice. You can say, well, I just want to assume that there is something to all loops and that there's an integration constant from unimodular gravity that cancels that. That is still what I would call fine-tuning, in the sense that it's not a paradox, but it is very peculiar if you say there is a contribution from matter fields that just happens to, from whatever the matter is in the standard model and whatever is beyond it, that just happens to be canceled out by a choice of an integration constant. I'm a little uncomfortable with that. But my attitude towards this is mainly that it may be pointing at something more interesting going on. Oh, and then I guess I should add that for the truly desperate, there are anthropic arguments. Let me ask a really stupid question. What if the cosmological constant really were huge, would we necessarily know it? Now, the obvious answer is yes, of course, we're measuring something that's at least 60 orders of magnitude smaller than the constant that I'm talking about here. Or else the answer is no, we wouldn't, because we wouldn't be here. But either of those answers contains a hidden assumption of homogeneity, that the effect of a cosmological constant is well approximated by its effect in a homogeneous universe where we understand the effect fairly well. But if this is being generated by quantum fluctuations at the Planck scale, then maybe homogeneity is not such a good assumption. And you can ask whether something like a large cosmological constant could be hidden in fluctuations at the Planck scale. Now, if we were talking about a Riemannian space, a space with positive definite metric, it would be very easy to imagine something like that. If you look at a golf ball, the curvature at small scales is very high, and it alternates between positive curvature in the indentations and negative curvature at some of the saddles between them. And when you look on the large scale, there's still some curvature, but it's much, much lower. And if you take a giant golf ball, the large scale curvature can be as small as you like, while the small scale curvature is very high. Now, in a space-time, this is trickier, because what people will normally tell you as well, cosmological constant causes exponential expansion. And it's hard to see how to average that out. But of course, that's not quite true. The field equations are time reversal invariant. So you can have regions that are expanding and regions that are contracting, and perhaps still have some kind of average effect that is a small expansion on large scales. Now, that is a very hand-waving argument. What I hope to do in this talk is to go halfway beyond hand-waving to something more convincing. What I mean by halfway is that the way that I know how to formulate this problem is in terms of the initial value problem for general relativity. And at the level of initial values, I think that I can probably convince you that there is a nice answer, that there's some huge set of initial data in which the effect of a large cosmological constant is hidden. Yes?
Yeah. Just a comment. We do know something about higher dimensional analogs of your golf ball.
Mm-hmm.
You asked, you know, for yes. dynamical models of geometry where, you know, negative and positive
yes.
curvature.
Yes, next slide.
It does not happen.
In
non-perturbative models, one has studied, it does not happen.
Well, let's talk about this more. It depends on, let's talk.
What systems you talk about?
Right.
I'm just talking about fully dynamical, non-perturbative, blah blah.
Well, one particular one, right?
Well, dynamical triangulations, Wedge calculus, causal dynamical triangulations. This thing just that doesn't.
Okay, let's come back to that. If you can convince me, then that will save me some time and let me work on something new. Okay, so as I said, at the initial value level, this really does work for a very large collection of initial data. The evolution is much harder, and the quantum evolution is much, much harder. So I will say more about that towards the end of the talk, but more as a set of open questions than an answer. Okay, so this is the somewhat technical slide. Don't worry about details here. To formulate general relativity as an initial value problem, the initial data you need are a three-dimensional hypersurface, an initial surface, which has an intrinsic metric on it and an extrinsic curvature, which you can think of as either roughly the time derivative of the three-dimensional metric or as a description of how the hypersurface fits into a four-dimensional manifold. The extrinsic curvature splits into a trace piece, which is called and means the expansion. It's the logarithmic change of the volume element with time, and a traceless piece, which is the shear, that measures the stretching of the space in some directions while it contracts in others. These data are, and in keeping with the theme of this conference, I should mention that the first proof of that general relativity had a well-posed initial value problem was done by Yvonne Choquet-Bruha, one of the women in this field who does not get the recognition that she deserves, I think. So this data is not all independent. If it were, life would be much easier, but much more boring. The metric and extrinsic curvature have to satisfy a set of constraints. Don't worry about the details of the constraints. They're basically four of the Einstein field equations. The one point that I want to make about this initial value problem is that it has a time reversal symmetry of a sort. That is, that if you have a solution of the constraints with a metric and an extrinsic curvature, and you just reverse the sign of the extrinsic curvature, that's also a solution. Okay, so now here is the result that Wheeler didn't know that allows us to do much more with this idea of space-time foam than the basically speculation that existed before this. This is fairly new work. Fairly recently, Crucial, Eisenberg, and Pollock showed that you can take pieces of initial data and glue them together. That is, if you have two initial data manifolds, initial data surfaces with their own initial data, you can first of all topologically attach them together by a standard operation called a connected sum, where you cut a solid ball out of each of the manifolds and then just identify the edges, or equivalently cut a ball out and glue the two together through a wormhole. But what Crucial et al. Showed was that you can perform this operation on the initial data as well to form a good initial data set for the combined manifold in such a way that except for an arbitrarily small region near to this neck, it matches the initial data that you started with. This gives you a way of quickly constructing, at least formally, it's hard to actually write down explicit metrics for this, but constructing huge sets of initial data in ways that that have characteristics that are very different from initial data that had been considered previously. Yes?
So this is not glued onto R3. So is it asymptotically flat?
You can do. Okay, I think I actually broke that chair this morning. I lean back a little too far.
That's recorded, by the way.
Right, I know. I deny it. I never said that. It's fake news. So the answer is that you can, what I'm going to be talking about is closed manifolds, but you can take any one of these and attach it onto an R3.
Don Witt had a theorem years and years ago where he showed that when you do that, when you have R3 mm-hmm. with any of these primes attached to it, it always admits initial data.
Yeah.
So one of those things, yeah, so...
But so this is...
They've actually explicitly constructed
yes,
that.
This is different initial data. This is initial data that has a characteristic that Witts did not, which I'll get to in just a minute.
Okay, good.
Yes?
So just to clarify, are you saying that the initial data actually matches except in a small region?
Yes.
Exactly?
Yes.
Okay.
And then you satisfy the constraints in the recorder?
Yes. You can satisfy.
An explicitly, or it's an existence.
It's an existence theorem. It's an existence theorem and an approximate construction. There is a parameter that you can adjust. That you can do an explicit construction up to basically up to some inverse power of this parameter.
So I guess the balls have to be extremely small.
They can be small or large. It's just that the place that you You take balls of arbitrary size, but the place that you match the initial data is in an epsilon region outside those balls. But so it's really a very powerful construction. Yeah?
Does it, when you say it's a small region, does it mean its volume, its spatial volume is small?
Yeah.
And then what about its curvature?
The curvature can be made small by making the neck long.
That's right.
If you try to shrink down the neck, then you get higher curvature in those regions.
If the neck gets long, the volume might get big, unless the neck gets thin.
Well, yeah, the neck gets long and thin.
I see.
Yeah. So let me tell you why this is different initial data from what Don Witt talked about. I'll start with a particular example. Take a manifold with initial data G and K, any initial data you want. Witt talked about a very particular construction. Take an identical copy of the same manifold with data G and minus K and glue those together. What you get then is a manifold for which in any sensible definition, the average extrinsic curvature is zero because you have point by point matching of positive and negative. Furthermore, for most topologies, you can show that the resulting connected sum doesn't admit a slice of constant trace of the extrinsic curvature anywhere. That the evolution never of that manifold never admits a slice of constant trace K. That's what makes these really different, because before this construction, almost everything that was known was entirely about manifolds that admitted trace K time slicing.
But here, this isometry will have to do with the fact that the primes that you're gluing together are the same, right? So if you have different kinds of primes, you're not going to have an isometry.
Right.
Right, okay.
Yes. I didn't set this up, but so now suppose that you are gluing together some very large number of manifolds and that you have some collection of initial data that you want to choose from. Make it anything you want with the one condition that you're keeping microscopic time reversal invariance so that GK and G minus K are equally likely. Then if you put enough of these together, the average extrinsic curvature is still going to be zero because any given contribution is equally likely to come in with a plus or a minus sign. How fast it goes to zero depends on exactly what class of initial data you're allowing. But remember that a cubic centimeter already has a Google Planck volumes in it. So it would be fairly strange for this average to not be pretty near zero.
So what's the measure that you're putting on this?
Just counting.
Just counting?
I'm sorry. So for the average here, there's a whole lot of difficulty in defining averages in general and averages of tensors in particular. My argument is that this is true for any sensible average, for any average in which a piece with GK is given the same weight as a piece with G minus K.
Okay.
the average of Kij, Kij is not zero, it's quite large.
Yes, that's coming. It might be large, it depends, yeah.
No, I just have, are you assuming anything about lambda?
Not yet.
Clockian value?
Not yet. This is all completely independent of lambda. I mean, the construction is completely independent of lambda. Can be done.
You're using had lambda equal to zero.
What?
The constraint equations had lambda equal to zero.
Did they? I don't think so. No, there's a lambda.
Okay. So any value of lambda.
Any value of lambda.
So what about the neck? You're saying that neck k is not. You can ignore that because that. Things would go wrong.
That what?
You're gluing the things.
Yeah.
So k could be very big there.
Right, but it can be very small. It has a sign. I'll come to that. Okay, so I've given you a construction of what I would call foamy initial data. And the obvious question is, how typical is this? So the answer is that we don't know. I'm sorry, let me go back a step. There is an easy answer to that question, which is that you can do the gluing symmetrically, so the extrinsic curvature is opposite on the two sides of the neck. Okay, so for a fixed topology of the overall space-time, this kind of construction is probably fairly special. The necks contain marginally outer trapped surfaces. That means basically they're mini black holes. I've talked to a bunch of mathematicians and nobody knows how typical these are. Yeah.
Just since you're talking about black holes, there's also this Gannon theorem that says that if you have initial data on non-trivial topology, that singularities almost sure will develop.
Yes, I'll get to that too.
Okay, all right.
No, this time your timing was a little off. I think that's two. I think that's two slides. Yeah. Okay, so. On the one hand, if you're taking a fixed topology, this may not be really typical. On the other hand, if you have a space with a complicated topology, then topologically, it always has a unique decomposition into these minimal connected sum pieces, prime factors, up to one technicality if it's non-orientable, but that's irrelevant here. So if you want to say that quantum fluctuations should produce something with a complicated topology at the Planck scale, and you want to choose your initial data on each fundamental topological piece, then this construction is generic. And again, this is an assumption about the physics, but it seems plausible, at least, that local fluctuations should not have a preferred sign of extrinsic curvature.
Didn't understand something. You said for fixed topology, it's non-generic.
Right, for,
but
yeah.
But that could be a fixed topology with very many connected sum of very many primes.
Right, but generic or non-generic depends on partly on what you're saying about on what you think about the scale of the curvature fluctuations. If you have a fixed topology with a large number of primes and the metric is relatively independent on the different prime factors, then it is probably generic. If you have a fixed, but you can always take a fixed topology and just add pieces, just add big three spheres to it. And on those, then this is probably not generic. But nobody knows what a good measure is on topologies or on geometries.
What are the big three spheres?
Well, these are supposed to be Planck scale, so much bigger than Planck scale.
Right, but that's already non-generic, probably.
Nobody knows.
No one knows, but there's no reason that it's...
Yeah, I don't know. I really don't know. Okay, so far, what I've argued is that there's this initial data for which the average extrinsic curvature is zero, and that it's easy to construct and pretty common. What about the intrinsic curvature? Well, the only constraint on the intrinsic curvature is the constraint from the constraints, which you can look at, and you can see that there is a subset of this data for which if lambda is positive, there's a subset in which the square of the expansion average is large. If lambda is negative, where the square of the shear is large on average, in which you can choose the intrinsic curvature on average to be small. Whether there's some physical mechanism for this, I don't know, but I'll come back to that at the end, maybe. Yeah?
Steve, are you aiming to show that there is some choice of initial data that will
I am hoping for the latter, but for the short time, aiming for the former. I mean, ideally, this would be an argument that for some choice of what you mean by generic. Initial data, generic topologically complicated initial data with a cosmological constant still has lambda nearly invisible at large scales.
And I'm worried about if we're evolving classically initial data, this was mentioned before and I didn't understand the response. I'm worried about the development of singularities.
Okay, so you're a page or two ahead of me too. I will get to that, I promise.
I'm sure I'm waiting for
you. I will maybe get to there. Evolution. Two naive expectations. One is that expanding regions are going to grow, contracting regions are going to shrink, so the expanding regions win. The other is that, well, there's nothing special about this initial data slice we chose. So if this topologically complicated structure is produced by quantum fluctuations, then as an expanding region grows, it'll fill up with fluctuations and the structure will reproduce. Alternatively, as Unruh and Wang have pointed out, if lambda is less than zero, you don't have a choice of expansion and contraction. You have each little region expanding and then contracting. And so the thing is more naturally self-reproducing. This is hard. It's partly because we're averaging, and here it matters what kind of average you're using. How does the region you're averaging with over change in time? How does the measure you're using to average change with time? What do you mean by time? Does this depend on a preferred choice of time slicing? And it's also probably highly non-classical in the sense that this initial data contains something like a Planck density of marginally outer trapped surfaces, so you're going to get a whole lot of singularities. Everybody assumes that quantum gravity, if we really knew how to do it, would somehow eliminate these singularities. I don't have anything new to say there, except I hope that's true. So you can ask a preliminary question, though, which is whether there is any classical evolution that preserves these averages. And this is tricky. I'm not going to go through the, I don't have time to go through details here. But the basic idea is that in order to describe classical evolution, you have to choose a time slicing. And some time slicings are more useful than others. For instance, when we say the universe is homogeneous, what we mean is there is a choice of time for which space at a fixed time is homogeneous. So you can ask the classical question, is there any choice of time slicing for which, for instance, the average of the trace of the extrinsic curvature remains zero? And you can work out the derivatives, and you get an answer that some infinite series, I mean, you have to work out all of the time derivatives, and I obviously haven't done that. But it looks as if, for short times at least, there is a particular large set of choices of time slicings for which the structure is preserved. Beyond that, we really need quantum gravity. This is terra incognita. We don't actually know whether quantum fluctuations produce this foam-like structure, much less how they evolve it. It might not be quite as hard as it seems, because you have the advantage that in typical quantum theories, what really matters is the constraints and not, in some sense, the rest of the Einstein equations. But this is something for somebody in the audience to answer. Thank you.
It's a very beautiful idea. So what it sort of depends on critically on the fact that, you know, if you give me a metric and extrinsic curvature, the metric and minus extrinsic curvature is also kind of satisfies constraint. But if you add spinner fields, this is not quite true, because what happens is that the spinners of one helicity connect with these connections, which have, if you like, in terms of metric and such thing, they, uh-huh. they look at, they couple to gamma, which is the connection coming from a metric,
uh-huh.
plus I times the extrinsic curvature.
Uh-huh.
There's a self-dual particle. And the other one is gamma minus RK times the extrinsic curvature. So if you do this, so supposing I was doing this classical problem, just but I had spinner fields, then you would have to kind of say that the spinner fields somehow also fluctuate their helicity.
Yeah.
All over the place. You're happy with that?
I hadn't really thought about that, but if you're talking about initial data, then I would say that when you're choosing your initial data for the spinners in any given prime factor, you can choose a helicity, and I would expect each choice of helicity and sign of extrinsic curvature to be as likely as a choice of opposite helicity and opposite sign of.
But there we do see particles with one helicity, right? I mean, they don't cancel out.
Yeah.
In some macroscopic, I mean, compared to.
Right. The, right. Okay. So that's true. This is something I hadn't thought of, and perhaps.
I have before, but I had not thought of that at that time either. So.
Yeah, I mean, presumably.
CPT type symmetry.
Well, so that's, I think that there ought to be a CPT kind of symmetry here, but I haven't thought about it.
But I'm talking about just, say, neutrinos, in which case there's no C.
Yeah.
Parity would be violated.
So. Neutrinos are massive, so. I mean, this one question is, do you care about classical solutions of the spinners? But also, they're massive, so
yeah.
they will Yeah, most felicities will be there.
Yeah.
With the anti-neutrinos.
So I have only looked at the vacuum case, and I'm not sure I have much. I could make up an answer, but.
So Lee is trying to ask the question. Yes.
In my mind, the idea of space-time film was always connected with some other ideas, which I think are worth mentioning, especially if the theme of the discussion is connections between different approaches. So the metaphor of space-time film, I always had the feeling that although we couldn't express it very well, this is what John Lewis was thinking about when Christ did what other people were thinking about. It was connected with the idea that the dimensional reduction, that there was a kind of fractal, when you say foamy, it was just the mechanics. It's they immediately think about fractal dimension, scalar dimension. And that was connected to the idea really of asymptotic safety, that and the idea of dimensional reduction, which occurs from several different locations. And finally, when we started playing with spin networks, revolution spin phones and the quantum gravity. The idea that's why John Myers called these spin phones. If he was to realize this picture of dimensional reduction, either reducing the divergences or cutting off the divergences by means of the non-smooth foamy picture of space-time and discrete geometry.
Yeah.
And so I'm just interested in taking this sort of very classical interpretation. To me, the power of the idea was in my connection with ideas about dimensional reduction, normalization, asymptotic safety, and that was also basically the root of the gravity.
Well, I mean, I also like that picture very much and have worked on that quite a bit recently. I would love to be able to put these two things together. At the moment, I don't know how to do that, but I agree that there's a good possibility that.
Well, I would think because there's a version of you which has even written papers advocating
yeah.
We take very seriously the
dimension. Yeah. Yeah, and I agree, and but this is already a crazy idea. I'm not sure that I want to put. I don't know whether craziness is additive or multiplicative, or has a sign.
That's crazy because you get all the technology,
uh-huh.
The
yeah.
Navigation on fractals.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot that we gain.
Yeah.
So just a couple of comments. First was going back to your first slide about lambda. I mean, you of course know well that in an even crazier theory like causal sets, the numbers are
uh-huh.
natural.
Yeah.
So I think, I mean, you didn't, for some reason you didn't mention that, and I was wondering which of those three things is it hidden in? The crazy idea one, or it's definitely anthropic, but that's sort of that we can just more immediate question about
okay.
this Gannon's theorem, because singularities, so if you put in cosmic censorship, the sense is then that even if you started with this initial data with lots of topological structure, it would all get eventually hidden by a black hole, so that all that information would be so since it's anyway getting hidden by a black hole, what would it mean to a cosmological constant today? Because there's no all that space. I mean, since you're using sort of this mixture of classical and the quantum, I'm not entirely sure
right.
how, but then anything outside of the black hole, which is presumably where we live, is
no, I think we.
So I'm saying this, you worry about the singularity resolution, as it's inside the black hole somewhere, and then you worry about that later. But the cosmological constant in this fluctuating form, in this semi-classical picture, I'm not sure how it would be relevant to any of our observations today. That's, I guess, my question.
Yeah. Right. So two things, well, three. One is that if this picture is right, we don't live in a black hole, but we have black holes living in us, in the sense in the sense that at this microscopic, truly microscopic structure, there are quantum fluctuations that, among other things, are producing black holes all the time. The black holes are instantly evaporating. And in order for this picture to make sense, in order for this picture to be right, it has to be true that whatever the ultimate quantum theory of gravity is, it reproduces this structure of fluctuations as the universe evolves. If that doesn't happen, then I agree that it's at least it's very hard to see what this would mean. Although these are Planck scale black holes, so they evaporate immediately. The other thing about causal set theory is that you do still have to put in that the bare cosmological constant before you do the counting is zero. And that's the cosmological constant that I'm worried about here.
Okay, so
being very fond of triangles, as you have occasionally also been, isn't there some way to kind of quantitatively assess this issue of how generic are those things? By simply, thinking of some relatively straightforward modeling of, your quite special geometries with these components that you repeat and compare them to, generic counting of, just general other, general geometries.
Mm-hmm. Right. So this,
using the fact basically that the counting for generic geometries is kind of exponential with volume. And then if you start allowing non-trivial, topological things, then it immediately goes, of course, super exponentially. So if you have some model where, you have kind of components with individually certain volumes, couldn't you make a kind of quite simple-minded counting or estimate of the size of the, these configurations?
Let's talk about that. It might be possible. I mean, it's a little tricky because, among other things, there are an infinite number of different prime factors. But if you just restrict to those that
to a finite volume.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
One of the projects that I had in mind for a student, but I'll give this out to anybody who wants it because I don't have a student who wants it at the moment, is that it would be, free. I'll pay you. it would be interesting to take some samples from CDT or from dynamical triangulations and just take a bunch of small subspaces and see what the topologies are to see whether you have already generated things that are complicated connected sums.
That is more complicated than becomes a kind of dynamical issue, but I'm just thinking about just assessing sizes of certain, regularized versions of your configuration or initial data space.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's just in the initial data.
Well, but even for good CDT initial data.
So if this is not very urgent, I think we should move on to the next. We finished this one with the homework. So let's thank you.